last case of the day. Oh, patient ones. 082357, United States versus Bach Young. And it's Mr. Foster. How are you?
Fine, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, Mr. Radcliffe. Judge, my name is Jim Foster. I was appointed to represent Bach Young at the trial court level and at this level. And there was a guilty plea down below, and our appeal is sort of focused in this. We are complaining that what we got was a pre-Booker sentencing in a post-Booker world. And the cases that out of this circuit that we think are really exemplary of our position is primarily the Cunningham case and the Carter case. And in Cunningham, in particular, where the court points out that just having a stamp refer to a statutory sentencing does not make that the real world. And it also points out, if there's any argument with merit that's not even addressed by the court, that would support an inference that there had either been an oversight or an error. In this particular case, there was quite a bit of time that was spent on the guidelines. There were some arguments about managerial and pseudo-victims, which we'll get to shortly. But the court's entire reference to the statutory provisions, we cited in our brief, it's in the appendix, page 37, when the court gives the colloquy just before sentencing and basically says, I have to look at the crimes and indicates what it has to look at, looks at the crimes, a look at what Congress passed as laws. I have to decide based upon all the evidence in the case, the comments of counsel, the credibility of the witnesses and your actions, what a fair sentence would be. And then I also have to look at the factors that your attorney alluded to, the Title 18 U.S. 3553. That's it. That's the extent that the court addressed the statutory positions that was attempted by Bach Young to be brought to the attention. Now, what were those? Bach Young argued in memorandum, she argued in front of the court, the short time period involved, 5 months that she worked at this location. She argued that she had spent 2 years and 2 months on effectively home detention. She referred to her 45 years of her life, non-crime, and her work ethic, and submitted even the work ethic, if you will. It's almost a cliche in a politically incorrect statement of Oriental life, that she worked 12 to 16 hours a day either in a bakery or a laundry. She did that 6 days a week. We spoke to the lack of analogy between the Mann Act, which is the underlying act, the Travel Act conviction, and what happened in this case. We spoke to the fact that Tudor, who was referred to as the money man, got probation. We spoke to the fact that an owner by the name of Choi got a fine in this case. In response to that, all Bach Young got was this reference by the court, is that I have to look at the factors that your attorney referred to. Now, we believe that Cunningham stands for the fact that if any of those are meritorious positions, to simply not even address them gives the inference that the court is dealing in the pre-Booker world. I lost my train of thought there for a second. But
you made reference to the counsel, and that's where the judge took that into consideration. Apparently the lawyer went through all the things you just said needed to be addressed in the 3553 analysis. And I guess I have to look at it. I look at this dissertation and does leave out a specific. Is it enough to just refer to say, I took all the things your counsel said into consideration, or does he have to repeat it and then say that?
Yeah, we're treading in that world where I don't believe that you have to write a treatise, as some of the cases say, on each one. But in this case, there was simply no reference to any point. And I think Cunningham sets up sort of a prophylactic rule. No one knows what's in a judge's mind. And now in the post-Booker world, I believe that that prophylactic rule is such that if one is presented to the court an argument that has some merit, I believe the court must address that argument not directly. And I think, again, Cunningham, there's an area in Cunningham where they said the court could not just have a stamp that said, I've considered the statutory factors. And I think the real reason all the cases indicate that this court, this circuit, must be satisfied that the court has exercised appropriate consideration of the statutory factors, the 3553. I submit to you it's impossible for this court to be satisfied that the court has appropriately considered the 3553 factors if the court does not even address them. I think I noted it in my reply brief, and I would candidly repeat it again here. When a defendant goes in front of a court and presents the statutory factors and argues for those factors and presents them to the court, if it is sufficient that they simply get a guideline sentence with no articulation or no indication to the parties or to this court, indeed, no indication on the record of what factors were considered, if that is the law, then there is no post-Booker protections today because, like we say, we can't get into their head. Now, the other area that I get to very quickly, there were arguments over managerial and over pseudo victims. And in this particular case, the government relies, and I'm going to jump to the pseudo first because that's the one where there's the least amount of conflicting evidence. The government relies on the fact that the pseudo-victims were the other people working in this spa, and the government says because they only got paid through tips and because tips were only a result of sexual favors, thus they were inducing these victims to commit acts of prostitution. In that regard, I would simply point out the government had two witnesses. They made material witnesses out of them. They presented them in this case. One witness was last name of Kim, Soon Kim. The other witness was Palmer. Both of these witnesses testified in their depositions. Kim was Exhibit 9, the government's evidence, and Palmer was Exhibit 10. They both testified that they split the fees. They split the, quote, gate fee, if you will, $50 to get into the house or $70 to get into the house, depending on a half hour, an hour, and then tips later. So that is based upon a fallacious premise by the government that it was based upon they had to do sexual favors and Bok Young must have known that, thus she enticed them. If you're splitting the entrance fee with the worker, then the worker is not relying upon that. I see that I'm getting into my rebuttal time. Unless there's a direct question, I'll reserve what time I have left.
Okay. Mr. Radcliffe.
Good afternoon. My name is Tom Radcliffe. I represent the government in this case. I'd like to start first with Mr. Foster's arguments regarding the enhancements here and the argument that he concluded with that was specifically that the government was relying on a false premise in arguing to the district court that the other women who worked at the spa providing sexual favors during the time that the defendant was working there were coerced into it because they were only receiving as salary or as any payment, frankly, for their efforts there. They were only receiving tips for sexual services. The district court pointed to that and said, okay, that's evidence that they are being coerced financially because if they're not getting a cut, if they're not getting any other payment for working at the spa and they're only getting paid for tips, paid in tips for sexual favors, then that's coercion. Therefore, they are victims. Therefore,
which is it? Because it seemed to me there was sort of a conflicting interpretation. On one hand, they say, well, they're getting half and then maybe tips. And the other half say they're getting only the tips.
That's what I was leading up to, Judge Mannion. In my long run up there, what I was going to say is there may be a conflict here. However, the defendant points to what she believes are conflicting statements in the material witness depositions of Ms. Kim, who was one of the women performing sexual services. But The defendant settled, we argue, settled definitively this issue of whether the house was getting the house money, the entrance fee, and whether the women were getting only tips. The defendant settled that issue in her change of plea hearing. I summarized what the defendant said in her change of plea hearing on page 7 of my brief. The defendant herself said the women who were providing sexual services were only getting paid in tips. That's it. End of story.
Who's getting all the rest? If they're getting only the tips, your defendant's getting $3,000 a month. The owner's getting $1,000 a month. Is that it? Is there another pot of money going somewhere?
During the there is not, as far as we know, Your Honor. During the time that the defendant in this case was the manager of the spa, it wasn't doing well enough financially to generate much money in addition to the $3,000 that she was getting and then the $1,000 that Ms. Thompson, the spa's owner, was getting. So there is no evidence that I know of regarding any other money from these house fees going to anybody else.
Well, they must not have been doing very well considering what they were recycling. Was there some testimony that whoever answered the door to the spa decided who was going to take the customer? Because I wondered how that factored into the manager's supervisor enhancement.
Judge Rovner, I will acknowledge also that there was a little confusion on that issue as well about whether the person who answered the door got to decide whether they were taking that customer or whether, in fact, the defendant was going to decide who got which customer. However, Judge, that is one of probably 25 factors. I think it's realistic to say 20 or 25 factors that supports the government's belief and the district court's conclusion that the defendant was exercising supervisory or management authority at the spa. So even if we were to take out that conflicting factor, I think there's still a panoply of evidence here demonstrating that the district court was not clearly erroneous in finding that the defendant deserved the 3B1.1 enhancement as a manager or supervisor in this case. And, Your Honors, with respect to the defendant's other argument, the lead-off argument in oral argument here, that the district court, as I think Mr. Foster said, imposed a pre-Booker sentence in a post-Booker world, I want to point out a few things. First, the court is well aware that there is no requirement. The Seventh Circuit has not created any requirement. The Supreme Court has not created any requirement for district courts to recite magic words. Now, I will acknowledge that Judge Lozano's analysis here in terms of the statements that he put on the record did not go through a litany of 3553A factors. And, of course, under the Dean decision, there is no requirement for a district court judge to list all those factors. I think it is sufficient in this case that Judge Lozano did point to the fact, did acknowledge the fact, I should say, that he had considered the 3553, as he called them, 3553 factors. He did not say 3553A factors, but he had considered those factors, including, as he said he always has to do, the crimes that a defendant has been convicted of. That alone, Your Honor, is enough to indicate that Judge Lozano was working in the post-Booker world in terms of how he worked through his analysis of what sentence to impose in this case. And I think it's important to make a distinction that I don't think defense counsel makes in this case, which is the distinction between any requirement that a judge may have to point to 3553A factors in arriving at his or her sentence versus any requirement that may be imposed for the judge to look at or to specifically address requests for non-guideline sentences or reasons why a non-guideline sentence might be appropriate in this case. The defendant complains that, and Mr. Foster went through a list of the reasons that apparently supported the defendant's request for a non-guideline sentence. Mr. Foster argued just now that the defendant had pointed to the fact that she was 45 years old, that she had only been working at the spa for a short time, that the, as he said, there was no analog to the Mann Act here, that Tudor and Choi, some of the other defendants in the case, received either a fine or probation, that she had been experiencing a difficult life and had worked many, many hours. The problem is that the only arguments that the defendant made at the sentencing hearing to support her request for a non-guideline sentence were the three things that I listed on page 16 of my brief. First, counsel asked for the court to consider the sentences of two other defendants in the case. So there was that issue. But the next thing that she asked for, Mr. Foster asked for on behalf of the defendant, was simply he argued that the defendant would, quote, not be aided by going to prison. That was the extent of that second request. And the third and final request, supporting the request for a non-guideline sentence, was that she had been confined, quote, on basically home arrest, unquote, since the spa had been raided. Your Honors, the other arguments that were made in support of the non-guideline sentence request were arguments that were made in submissions to the probation department, some of which Judge Lozano had to not officially strike, but effectively struck by calling Mr. Foster into chambers and putting it on the record that those submissions to probation were incomprehensible. The probation department wrote a memo to Judge Lozano explaining, we can't make sense of what the submissions are, what Mr. Foster is asking for. Judge Lozano ended up consolidating and having several hearings and forcing both parties in this case, certainly forcing the defendant, to come up with a list of everything that's at issue. And he said repeatedly, this is not addressed in the brief, I recognize, but he said repeatedly, is this everything? Are we dealing with all the issues now? Now, many of those went to the 3B1.1 and the pseudo-count enhancements. But because of that history, I don't think it's reasonable for the defendant to now come in and say, well, we had all these other arguments, and so there's a list now of five or six or seven or eight things that Judge Lozano did not address specifically on the record.
So what you're saying is if the attorney doesn't recite 3553 things that he's looking at and wants to consider, and I'm sure they would all be mitigating, then the judge doesn't have to analyze it because he doesn't.
That's correct.
He says, I have to take a look at the factors that your attorney alluded to, and after that, if you consider those, I consider the reasonable sentence, and he refers to 3553E, for that's worth. But that's it. He doesn't go through and say, well, you were this or that, and you know, you're abused as a child, and all the other stuff that sometimes they want you to talk about.
That's correct, Your
Honor.
So,
I guess that's where we left.
I think it's a logical corollary to the point that the court need not address the frivolous, under Cunningham, need not address frivolous arguments at sentencing, particularly if the court has asked the parties to, at the sentencing hearing, ensure that all issues are brought before the court. And any issues that aren't fall away, either under a waiver or forfeiture distinction. I suppose the forfeiture would be the appropriate analysis in that case. But because the district court did not then take the time to go through specifically each of the requests, each of the reasons for a non-guideline sentence, that does not mean that the district court has committed either procedural or substantive error, regardless of where the need to, that any perceived need to address the non-guideline factors falls under, whether it falls under the procedural or falls under the substantive heading. Just because they're not all addressed specifically certainly does not mean that there's any error, and certainly does not mean that there's any error in this case, especially because the defendant received a bottom-of-the-guidelines sentence in this case.
Thank you.
Your Honor, seeing no further questions, the government asks, of course, that the court affirm the decision and the sentence of the district court.
Thanks, Mr. Radcliffe. Mr. Foster.
Just on the litany, yes, there were several briefs filed in this case. There were several memorandums. All the matters that I mentioned to this court were brought up in front of brought to the court's attention either in writing or as articulated. I haven't really read I don't want to contradict counsel without having the song and verse in front of me. He admits that I mentioned the 2 years home detention specifically verbally. The work ethic was an exhibit that was submitted to the court. It showed the work, and it showed Saturday through Sunday. I mean, what else can you do? To suggest that the court doesn't have to go through it, I think, violates what the case law is, because if the court can do what this court did and merely say, I have to consider 3553 and then address none of the 3553 that was brought to the court's attention either orally or in the writing, if that is all it takes, then I respectfully submit there is no post-Booker teeth. I see the orange light coming on. There's one thing I do have to admit, and as counsel fairly points out, it was not addressed in the brief. He alludes to it at this point. I really think it's kind of a paper tiger. I don't think that the court was misled or down any primrose path by myself and the techniques that I used when answering the court. I will point out that on July 26, 2007, and it's found 204 of the record, there was a docket text that pointed out there had been some misunderstanding in the submissions to the probation department. The probation department claimed I wasn't citing to the probation department authority. The court then asked that an order be submitted. The government submitted an order, and that's 207. When I read that order, it appeared as if I had been contemptuous. It said that the judge had warned me. It used adjectives of this and that. I filed an objection to that order, August 15, 2007, found in the record 213. I said, none of this happened because we didn't have any hearing. So I don't think it's appropriate for the government at this stage to bootstrap that order and suggest that misled the court into not being able to address 3553 factors. I think under Cunningham, if the arguments raised by Bok Young were frivolous, I'm the first to admit the court did not have to address them. I don't think they were frivolous. I think they had to be suggested, and I think Cunningham meant what Cunningham said when it said that the record has to assure you that the court considered the 2553 factors, and I submit respectfully that you cannot be convinced of that from this record. Thank you.
Okay, now, Mr. Foster, you were court appointed. Thank you for the fine job you did for your client. Thank you, Mr. Ratcliffe, for the fine job you did.